This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome to the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. In the second hour of our program, we're going to get into what happened over the weekend with the Rules Committee and the DNC and all this kind of thing. There's a lot going on there. Well, we can get into some of it this hour as well. First, though, perhaps the larger picture, politics in America, the history of politics in America, how it goes, war and peace, issues of you know, really significant import. Pat Buchanan has a new book out. It's called Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, How Britain Lost Its Empire and the West Lost the World. And Pat Buchanan, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom. Delighted.
Glad to have you back with us. I read your book over the weekend, or I read most of it, and certainly the first and last chapters, and I'd say probably 70% of the rest of it. There was a limit to my time, but
that's very good of you.
I spent a lot of time on an airplane. I read your book where the right went wrong, and I've read several of your books, and other than the last chapter, which I thought was kind of gratuitously Republican. I actually wanted to make it one of our recommended BuzzFlash Book of the Month books, but Mark disagreed with me. I think in large part because it was you. But you took on George Bush in a way that was pretty unambiguous in that book, and you do in this book as well. The way that you wrap this book up, I mean, you know, some of these quotes are about George W. Bush in the White House. Pretty unambiguous. You call him, you say, George W. Bush is a president. After 9/11, the project took on urgency when George W. Bush, a president disinterested and untutored in foreign policy, was converted to a Wilsonian ideology of democratic fundamentalism. Explain your notion of democratic fundamentalism.
Well, I think, well, Scott McClellan pretty much confirmed it, but we didn't need much confirmation. You could tell it in my book, The Day of Reckoning, which was out about last fall, Tom. I went through all of Bush's major foreign policy addresses, and he has in there, it is saturated with this ideology of what you might call the global democratic crusade, the freedom crusade. It is rooted in the belief that America cannot be secure in this world unless the whole world is democratic. It's sort of a takeoff of Lincoln's, we cannot remain half slave and half free. Either we will be all slave or all free. Now, Bush has sort of extended this in a false way, in my judgment, to the whole world. America has always lived in a world where there have been despots and dictators and monarchs and empires. And we've managed our security by keeping our powder dry and our arms in good shape and by staying out of others' wars.
Walk softly and carry a big stick, as Teddy Roosevelt said.
Yeah, exactly. But Bush's idea was that we have not only a providential duty but an imperial necessity to democratize these dictatorships, and especially in the Islamic world, and we've got to get there first and turn them into democracies or we cannot be secure. And this was behind his drive, I think, to Baghdad, as we find from Scott McClellan. The idea was to democratize Iraq, overthrow Saddam Hussein, turn it into a functioning democracy. Iran and Syria would see the handwriting on the wall. They would become democratic. The Palestinians would sit down with the Israelis. It is a utopian concept. It is a Wilsonian concept, except where Wilson was going to make the world safe for democracy, Bush is going to make the whole world democratic.
Period.
And this idea drove us into the war in Iraq.
Now, in your book, you make a very strong case that Churchill, through a series of blunders, particularly leading up to World War I and then again leading up to World War II, basically produced two wars that didn't have to happen, hundreds of millions of deaths, or certainly tens of millions of deaths that didn't have to happen. That his you have a chapter about the Churchill cult. In fact, you end the book with the last sentence of your book about how George Bush has a bust of Churchill in his office, and you do a pretty good job of taking apart Churchill, and I frankly I think much of it's deserved. But the book it seems that the primary thesis of the arc of your book, and please tell me if I've got this completely wrong, is that Britain having empire all across the world. You talk about how, when England showed up, the British, I think actually it was largely the Dutch, but nonetheless showed up in South Africa, you know, they found people who were not the modern civilization, and they brought them the tools of modern civilization, and the same in Uganda, and the same in, Sudan, and the same, fill in the blank, all across the world. And none of that was democratic. All of that was empire.
Right.
And it seemed to me that throughout your book, the subtext to the thesis was Britain holding the world. It was very Hobbesian, frankly. The idea that without, as Hobbes talked about in Leviathan, without the iron fist of church or state, people will devolve into anarchy, and democracy is simply another form of anarchy, and that empire was a necessary thing, and that we had the opportunity then to be the empire, and Bush blew it with his religion of democracy.
You know,
it seems like this is a fundamentally anti-democratic message.
Well, no, it is not. Look, let me say this. I'm an American conservative. They call me a neo-isolationist. I'm just an anti-interventionist unless I believe the wars are justified.
Well, I'm an American liberal, and I would characterize myself the same way.
Yeah, but, I believed in the Cold War. I believed the Soviet Empire was a genuine threat, and the only military action I opposed was my friend Ronald Reagan introducing the Marines to Lebanon, because I just could not see the vital interest there, and it was a chaotic situation.
Well, what about Reagan and Grenada? Reagan in Nicaragua, or Reagan in El Salvador? Why?
Let me just see it. We're getting
okay, we're getting off track here.
Okay. Okay. Just a second, Tom.
Sure.
They're going to test the alarm system.
Oh, no.
Let me keep going right here. I hope they're doing that, and I'm over here in the men's room, okay?
Okay, no problem.
Okay,
we can't hear it in the background. The audio is coming through fine.
Let me make my case, because I think we're off track.
All right.
Here's the point. I think the British Empire clearly did a lot of wicked things and unconscionable things, the potato famine, the opium wars. But I think it also brought civilization to an enormous part of the world. And the point I'm making here is that Churchill was an imperialist, undoubtedly. But he had a lust for war. He was the main driving force to bring the cabinet around to war in World War I, because he lusted for war with Germany. He was a Germanophobe. He believed they could make great gains for the empire. That was a disastrous war, 700,000 dead. And he himself sort of declined morally, imposing a starvation blockade on Germany that killed something in the neighborhood of 700,000 women and children. Secondly, in World War II, the Nazis were of a malevolent people, but Hitler's record of murders basically added up in the main sense to the Rome Purge of 1934 and the horrific pogrom of Kristallnacht, which killed about 300 people or something like that. And the point is about Hitler, it's not that he was a good man at all. He was very wicked, but he did not want war with Great Britain. He wanted to preserve the British Empire. He was an enormous admirer of the empire. He did not want war with Western Europe. He wanted back the territories lost in the East. He wanted to unite with Austria. He wanted the Sudetenland back. He wanted Danzig and Memel. There is no evidence he ever prepared for a great war. And so the great blunder of the British was at the time after Munich, when Czechoslovakia collapsed and Hitler made a protectorate out of the Czech Republic, what was left of it, which was the same situation it had been before 1918, the British insanely handed a war guarantee to Poland.
Right.
And they told the Poles, in effect, if you fight for Danzig, the British Empire will fight alongside you, when the British government believed Danzig to be returned.
But Poland was one of the places where the Jewish community in Poland took the largest hit from Hitler's
exactly.
annihilation. How, if the British had done as you suggest and simply said, okay, Hitler, you can have Poland, you think he would have simply let the Jews alone?
Yes. I mean, he had no... Look, you say let the Jews alone. What was Hitler's policy in Germany?
Well, his basically, policy he laid out in Mein Kampf was to exterminate the Jews.
He did not say that in Mein Kampf. But his whole policy, look at his policy. This is one of my points. The Holocaust was a crime against humanity and a crime against the Jewish people, but it was also a war crime. Had there been no war, there would have been no Holocaust. Had the British not given the war guarantee to Poland, Hitler, at the very least, would never have attacked in the West.
But Hitler had started eugenics programs long before the war.
The eugenics programs were 1940, and they were against children and misfits and others. They were horrible. And as I point out, Churchill was for these kinds of things.
Pat, can you stick around through the break?
Oh, sure.
Okay, great. We've got to take a break here. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, live coast to coast. Pat Buchanan with us. His new book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, How Britain Lost Its Empire and the West Lost the World. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Fighting for the common man and the common good.
The Tom Hartman Program.
The hour. It's Tom Hartman here with you. Pat Buchanan with us. His book, Churchill, Hitler and the Unnecessary War, How Britain Lost Its Empire and the West Lost the World. Pat, I just for the record, I mean, just this thing about eugenics. Eugenics started in the United States in a big way in the 19-teens and 20s.
Right.
Hitler's posters promoting eugenics in the 30s were based on American eugenics. Actually, it started in the United Kingdom. It came to America. We were a little more aggressive about it. I lived in Vermont. The entire Abenaki Indian tribe was wiped out, or at least in theory. A lot of them went underground. I just have to, you know, and in Mein Kampf, Hitler wrote extensively about the Jews. He talked about the Jewish press, how if you peeled back any layer of anti-Germanism, you would find a little, he referred to them as Jewish maggots. I mean, I would submit to you that his destruction of the Jews would have continued if Churchill had not tried to defend Poland. It would have, the exact same thing would have happened.
All right, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
How many Jews did Britain save by declaring war on Germany?
Well, ultimately, you could argue very few.
You can argue none. My point is this, that the war was not fought for the Jews. The Holocaust was a consequence of the war. What I'm saying here is, if Hitler had, if the British had not given the war guarantee to Poland, Germany would have tried to negotiate Danzig with the Poles. Hitler didn't want war with him. He wanted to make them an ally, such as we had in Admiral Horthy.
But he was going through all this talk.
Hold on, Tom, now. He wanted to make them an ally. And when Britain gave the war guarantee, it was within 48 hours, he ordered up Case White, the invasion of Poland. If Britain hadn't declared war on Germany, they might very well have attacked Poland, but they would have stopped there. They would have had Poland, had their town. It only took them 3 weeks. The Holocaust came as a result of the war that Hitler launched on Russia. Now, why did he launch the war on Russia? It was because he was trying to end the war against the damn British, and he thought the British were relying on the Russians coming into the war. He said, if I knock them out, the Brits will make peace. We could end this war. Hitler desperately wanted the war ended because he was fearful that if he brought in the United States of America and a long war, he would lose. There would have been possibly no Holocaust in Poland, and almost certain at least the Jews of Norway and Denmark and Belgium and Holland and France and Italy and Yugoslavia and Greece would have survived. That's the point I'm making.
Yeah.
Look, there's nothing.
No, I got it. I got it.
And
hindsight's always 20/20. You open the book, which is not to denigrate it at all. You open the book by saying, as a share of the world population, peoples of European ancestry have been shrinking for three generations. The character of every Western nation is being irredeemably altered as each undergoes an unresisted invasion from the third world. We are slowly disappearing from the earth. Having lost the will to rule, Western man seems to be losing the will to live. You're speaking of white Anglo-Saxons or white Caucasians?
Well, predominantly Christian Europeans, but also it's also
Europeans.
True of the Japanese. But predominantly, yes. And when the people go, the civilization will grow. Anybody that thinks the folks coming in from all over the third world are going to be interested in Shakespeare, the American Civil War, things like that, I think, got another guest coming. You go out to California, they're celebrating Cesar Chavez Day and Cinco de Mayo.
And
they
yet
don't
I've,
care about Antietam Creek.
Well, I've known many African Americans and Hispanic Americans who are very eloquent and very well versed in Shakespeare.
Well, look, let me suggest.
Are you suggesting that race has something to do with the ability to maintain culture?
When I'm suggesting peoples preserve their own culture. That's right. Who is preserving the culture of the Jewish people of Central and Eastern Europe now? Maybe some people are trying to do something about it, but it is gone. If the people disappear, their culture and their civilization, I believe, will disappear. And I think it is happening. And that's why I wrote The Death of the West. The truth is, Western civilization came out of Jerusalem and Athens and Rome and, for us, London. And if our civilization goes, I don't know whether it will be Islamic, probably in Europe, very much Islamic. It is agnostic and atheistic here in an increasing way. You got folks coming in, pouring in from Mexico. They've got an Hispanic culture and language and tradition.
Well, it's by and large Catholic.
Pardon?
It's by and large Catholic.
Well, listen, there's a lot.
Which is European.
Yeah, but there are a lot of them Catholic, but the younger ones are affected the same way by the culture here. As people are everywhere.
To the larger picture, we just have a minute left. I'm sorry. Right. Just to the larger picture, history is littered with civilizations that have vanished or have morphed. I mean, Christianity itself is an amalgam of a dozen different things. What's wrong with that?
Well, I mean, if you think the suicide of the West is a good idea, then you shouldn't have read my Death of the West. But I happen to be a man of the West. An American and a child of European and Christian civilization. I think it's the greatest in the history of the world. I think when it goes, we're going to enter a dark age, and I think we're all, the whole world and all mankind will be worse off for it.
To paraphrase Buckley, you're standing astride history yelling stop?
No, I'm not yelling stop. I'm sitting here observing the train that's rolling right over us.
Yeah. So what's the solution? I mean, basically you said that England ruled by empire, and that ended with their stupid war decisions.
Well,
Should we have empire? U.S. empire?
No, the solution would have been after the Cold War for the United States, during its period of great predominance, to have been the lawgiver and peacemaker to the world.
But what to do now in the 10 seconds we have?
I think we ought to close down our pretensions to empire and bring the troops home.
Well, in that regard, I agree with you. Patrick Buchanan, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. Fascinating book. Thank you, Pat.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at
866-303-2270. How does it feel?
Four minutes past the hour. Our telephone number 1-866-303-2270, toll free nationwide and around the, well, it's not toll free around the planet, but in most places you can dial into it. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, which is free, just go to tomhartman.com and click live chat. No, you don't have to join anything or anything else. It's right there. You can drop in and hang out. I hang out there during the breaks. And, of course, our message board and our blogs are all there. There's also much of the same over at airamerica.com as well. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Shelley in Chicago, Illinois. Is that Shelley Drobny?
That's me.
Hey, Shelley. the guy who you and I conspired back in the day to create this radio network.
Yes. Long before it started.
I remember the very first meeting. So anyhow,
2002,
hey.
2002 in Northbrook, Illinois.
There you go. Yeah. Well, yeah. Thanks for calling. What's up?
Well, I was listening to Buchanan, and you and I are students of history, and I think Pat skewed it a little bit. I think he got a little wrong, and I think you'll probably agree that in 1939, his belief that Britain should not have declared war may have been a tactically correct thing because they had no common border with Poland, right? They actually did nothing
right
when Poland was attacked. we had this phony war, if you recall, for a year.
Right, but Hitler had been whipping up this whole thing of they have weapons of mass destruction, they've got the troops on their border, they're firing at us, they're preparing, and in fact, none of that was going on.
And by the way, my mother was from Poland, she just escaped before the war, and the idea that had Britain not declared war, they would not have set up ghettos in Warsaw and other places is patently absurd. You and I know that, okay?
I believe that to be true, and I at a certain point you don't yell at your guests, but I did want to highlight these differences. I am concerned that there's some significant rewriting of history going on here.
Yeah, and you know, Pat does that, and the only thing we agree about him is the fact that we shouldn't intervene. But one aspect that he missed, because he's such an anti-communist, that he completely ignored the Soviet Union's offer prior to their signing a pact with Hitler back in July and August, when the foreign minister was a Jewish man, not Molotov. It was Litvinov, who was a terrific guy. He was a friend and confidant of the West. And he offered a military alliance against Germany with France and England if the Soviet Union were allowed to come into Poland once Hitler attacked.
Right.
In other words, if Hitler attacked Poland, the Soviet Union wanted to go in there and fight him at the Polish border with Germany, not at the Russian border.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that would have shortened the war, as it were.
Oh, okay. Now, here's the deal. Believe it or not, Poland and England would not allow Russia to enter their border.
Yeah, well, they were trying to protect their territorial integrity.
I know that, but the fact is that they were trying to allow the Soviet Union could not do anything according to the negotiations unless they completely crossed the border, got into the border with Russia, and then waited until they got there. Now, that's patently absurd. And, of course, Hitler was saying in Mein Kampf he was the arch anti-communist.
Right.
The Soviet Union was pretty suspicious about that because when you have a war, you certainly want to stop them at a point where you have a buffer zone. Now, again, this is...
But the movement of the Soviet Union into Poland probably would have provoked Hitler even more. He would have had actual real stuff to point to rather than just phony stuff like Bush did with Iraq's WMDs. I mean, this would be like...
Let's say that. The issue is, though, would Hitler have attacked Poland had they had a military alliance with Russia? And my belief is no. They would not have had the military capacity to do that. And they weren't seriously negotiating with Russia because they hated Russia more than they hated Hitler.
So do you think as Pat suggests, that Poland was simply depending upon this secret defense treaty that they had with England, and that's why they went the way they did?
Well, I think that Poland actually believed that their army could hold them off, but you know that's insane. That's sort of like, you know, living in another world, because
it's sort of like Saddam Hussein thinking he could stop us.
Yeah, right. But the fact is, from a military point of view, it was patently absurd that the Brits guaranteed Poland without Russian guarantees. And that's an alliance that they would not make, and it was arrogance and hatred of communism. You know, Stalin was Stalin. I'm not defending him. But I'm talking about geopolitically, blind hatred of communism. And they end up being our ally anyway. So, you know, that was the mistake. Poland would not have been attacked, in my opinion, if there would have been a military alliance with the Soviet Union, because Hitler would not have been able to conquer Poland. It wouldn't have been a possibility because, you know, the Soviet army was the largest army at the time, and they were capable of standing up to Hitler, which they ultimately
did. So that's who Churchill should have been talking to. But everybody was suspicious of Uncle Joe, you know. It's
absolutely. But,
anyhow,
you know, when it comes to war, you know, suspicions have to be out the door, and you have to really kind of figure out, well, who is –
You end up being pragmatic, right? Yeah. Shelley, thanks a lot for the call. Shelley,
okay,
always great talking with you. Shelley Drobny, the guy who started this whole radio network here. Let's see, Brad in Andover, Ohio. Hey, Brad, welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to say 2 points. One, I'm a history major at Kent State, so I take personal offense that I almost said Robertson, Buchanan, misread history so badly in that he said that eugenics programs and Germany started in the 40s. They didn't. They started in the 30s. Hitler was actively writing praising letters back to the American eugenicists saying, what a great job you're doing. And he took a lot of the stuff from our the destruction of the Indians.
Right. That was my point.
Yeah, it was a great point to make. And, it, you know, Buchanan's book is great to look critically at Churchill, which we should do. But so much revisionist history is just mirrored in one man's point, and it's not a very good point to make. Second, when he got near the end of this, the whole fear that Western history and culture is going down the toilet thanks to pluralist tendencies and that we're, you know, too tolerant, I guess. That's a lie. The fact is there's McDonald's and KFCs in China. There are,
but they don't represent our culture. They represent our commerce, and our commerce and our culture are different things.
Well, our culture.
And I'm not defending Pat Buchanan in this context, but I think it is important to point out that there, if you want to characterize McDonald's as our culture, it's the worst part of our culture. I mean, the question of who's going to carry on the traditions of, for example, any of the great writers of Shakespeare, for example, who's going to carry on the traditions of Shakespeare? It's sort of like the Sumerians asking who's going to carry on the writings of Gilgamesh. I mean, the Sumerians vanished. This was 7,000 years ago the Epic of Gilgamesh was written. Well, it's still around. We still study it. We don't have cultures based on it, although I would argue that our entire culture actually is still based on the Epic of Gilgamesh. But nonetheless, it's, you know, cultures come and go. Cultures change. I really think at a certain point, particularly given, if you go back and read Pat's Buchanan, right, Pat's autobiography right from the beginning and some of his other writings, and he's not here to defend himself. I don't want to call him out on stuff that he can't rebut. But, it does seem that he is, well, let's even set aside Pat Buchanan for the moment. There is a large contingent in the United States. There's a large number of people. I think probably their most articulate spokesman on television is Lou Dobbs, who are concerned that as, let's just say it, the way, you know, that using the language that they won't, but they do in code, as the number of white people in this country declines in relation to the number of brown and black and yellow and red people in this country, using the grossest vernacular out there, that somehow they think that is going to damage this country. And I would submit to those folks that, in fact, yes, it's going to change our culture. Yes, it already has changed our culture. Yes, it is changing our culture. It's making our culture better. And to the extent that that Europe is becoming Islamized, I would submit to anybody that, yes, there's a huge wave of Islamic immigration into Europe, and the Islamic people in Europe are most white Europeans have zero population growth, and the Islamics, the darker skinned Islamics in Europe have higher birth rates. But what's happening is that by and large, I mean, there's a few exceptions, the crazies who bombed the London subways, but by and large, Islamic culture in Europe is adopting many of the values of Europe. It's transforming Islamic culture for the better, and at the same time, it's making European culture more tolerant and less interested in empire. You're ending up with Switzerland's and Sweden's, which, by the way, Switzerland is a country that Pat praises in his book. You're ending up with Switzerland's and Sweden's rather than empires like Great Britain and Germany.
Well, I agree that, you know, McDonald's or KFCs don't represent the best part of our culture. It's just the fact that they're becoming the dominant, not only representatives, but one of the dominant values of our culture anymore is consumerism. I mean, it's not something to be saying it's good. I'm not saying it's good. It's what is. And the fact that the great tradition of liberal arts and freedom and democracy that ran through our culture, and one of the reasons why we have, you know, industries and great inventions and people who can write books like Pat Buchanan and all these things that we would say for whatever reasons are good have fallen by the wayside as we've become more emphasized upon consuming and materialism and things of that sort. I would not say it's good, but I'm just saying that Pat seems to just ignore that completely. But it is a valid concern that our liberal arts tradition is falling by the wayside.
Yeah, but I think that that's a result of the attack from the right. Brad, thanks for the call. I mean, you know, the purging of our textbooks in the 1980s during the Reagan administration in our high schools and secondary schools and junior high schools, and even our primary schools, even our elementary schools. And now the ongoing purging of textbooks and professors by David Horowitz and friends in our colleges, that's changing our culture.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the Teamsters. Fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Colombia. Find out more over at Teamsters.org, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Gene in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Gene.
Hi. I think a lot of Pat Buchanan's points are rooted in his denial of his role in writing Reagan's speeches. I believe Buchanan was chosen to create a populist pose to cover Reagan's corporatism, not to express Reagan's actual intent. When focus group studies indicate the real policies won't be accepted by the people, the choice is made to create a phony sales pitch.
So you think that his populism is, well, in fact, let's take this out to a larger scale, because there are a lot of populists out, you know, Lou Dobbs and others. There are a lot of guys out there who are posturing as populists, and yet they promote a libertarian economic and political worldview, which is essentially in favor of giant corporate monopolies controlling virtually every aspect of our lives.
When I take this further to what was discussed about Bush, the same thing with Bush, the freedom to spread democracy, freedom, those were no more than hype and a pose. The focus groups must have indicated that the real policies could not be furthered unless there was some popularly accepted rationale. And so the public poses of both Reagan and Bush are fashioned to cover their real goals. That's my view, because they are using the focus groups. We know that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, everybody does. Everybody is. But interesting point, Gene. Thank you very much for sharing that. Interesting. Charles in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Charles.
Yes. I think he was attempting to make Hitler out to be misunderstood.
Well, throughout the book, and
yeah,
as I said, I've read most of the book, which I rarely have the opportunity to do when I have authors on. There are a few. I'm looking forward to David Sirota's new book, Uprising, by the way.
Hitler, he was a very, very hateful man. He used the Jim Crow laws and eugenics movement here in this country as a template to attack the Jews.
Yeah, absolutely.
And things just got progressively worse.
Right. And the Jewish shop things, signs, those were in 1938, as I recall. This was before the invasion of Poland, and that was inside Germany itself. So, yeah, Charles, interesting point. Thank you. Steve in Sussex, Wisconsin. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I think some of the stuff that Pat Buchanan is talking about is kind of simplified history, because you have to remember that Poland did not even exist in World War One, and everything that happened, including Adolf Hitler, is a product of World War One.
Right, and that's one of the points he makes in the book, is that the Treaty of Versailles, and this is a lesson that we should all learn. And in this, I think that Buchanan is right, that the Treaty of Versailles was so punishing to Germany that, you know, they saw the only way out of it. They had to, all these reparations that they had to pay to all the other countries that had been victims of what was perceived as their aggression during World War One was so punishing that they inflated their currency to the point that they could pay off those bills in deflated currency. The Bush administration is doing the same thing right now, not because a treaty was imposed upon us, but because Reagan, Bush, and Bush were imposed upon us, and we ran up a $9 trillion debt. Just like Germany had this multi-trillion dollar, Deutschmark debt.
That's true, Tom. But let me entertain a different thought a little bit the beginning of World War One as opposed to the end of the World War One. I think many people miss the fact that before World War One, Germany wanted a war. And Germany wanted a war largely because of this 40-year-old experiment that they were on, basically made Germans convinced that they are a superior race. And this was way before Adolf Hitler. This was way before eugenics.
Yeah, the cult of Blut und Erde, blood and earth.
Exactly. And the whole theory and the way they pulled little nations into the war, including the Habsburg Empire and its nations and the Ottoman Empire, was anti-Slavic propaganda.
Yeah.
And they
But see, the Germans, Steve, the Germans were not unique in that. The Slavs were saying the same things about themselves. You had people throughout the Middle East saying the same things about
true,
themselves.
But I suspect the Russians would have never attacked Europe if it wasn't the German nationalism. But to bring it home a little bit, how stupid this whole us versus them ideology is. Now we know from genetics, modern genetics, actually last 10-15 years, that the Hungarians who were pulled into World War One by basically telling them that they are different than the Slavs and using the Hungarian population to, you know, basically rule over the surrounding Slavic nations, was 60% of the Hungarians have this gene called R1A haplotype, which is the Slavic gene. 56% of the Polish have it, 50% of the Russians have it. And also, this is very interesting, 64% of the Kyrgyz and Tajik population has it, which is Asiatic, looking like Asians, and also 45% of northern Indian Hindi speaking.
Yeah.
So this whole thing.
So what we're discovering, Steve, excellent point, and thank you. What we're discovering is that we're all just us in so many ways. Mark, we only have 20 seconds left. A quick point from Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, briefly, I think what you're seeing with Buchanan and people like Lou Dobbs is what Alvin Toffler described back in the 70s in his book Future Shock. You
right.
get a society that changes so rapidly that some people just don't have the ability to adapt, and they end up having feelings of paranoia, similar to what when people go to a foreign country and they're in an environment where they don't speak the same language. Fortunately for people like that, they can come back to their home country. But if your country changes, where are you going to go?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and if you want everything to be exactly the way it always was, and that's the problem. Thank you, Mark. Everything is never going to be exactly the way it always was. So our challenge is how to, and I think Barack Obama is the great exemplar of this. How do we make a multiracial, multi-ethnic society that works for all of us? 57 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman.
Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The True People's Radio.
Tom Hartman.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Harold Ickes being interviewed right now by Andrea Mitchell on MSNBC. It seems the subtext of what he's saying is that the Clinton campaign is not, N-O-T, not, going to take this thing to the convention. It's not going to go to Denver, assuming that Barack Obama gets the nomination with the next two elections. And, I mean, in order for him not to, Hillary Clinton would have to get 80% of the unpledged superdelegates. And I just don't see it happening. I know a couple of them. And I know that they're not going to be coming out for her. I believe that they're not going to be coming out for her. I just don't see it happening. Tom Vilsack is now saying, hey, it's over. It's over at the top of Huffington Post. We're hearing a lot of conciliatory language. I think that Hillary Clinton, in my opinion, is doing three things. Number one, she is establishing her political credentials. She is making it clear to everybody in the United States that she is a politician who actually had the ability or has the ability to become president of the United States. The first woman to, I mean, you know, Farrar was on as VP, but the first woman to actually be within spitting distance of the presidency of the United States. And had she had one slightly less formidable opponent in this race, she would be the nominee for president of the United States, and in all probability, the next president of the United States, given what an incompetent campaigner and, well, actually, time will tell how good a campaigner he is, but what an incompetent in general John McCain is. But Barack Obama right now needs only 41 superdelegates. Hillary Clinton needs delegates, period. Hillary Clinton needs 200. We get a couple of elections coming up here. I think a couple more superdelegates and the elections, and there's going to be that moment Tuesday night where hopefully a couple of superdelegates will come out, and hopefully the way it gets played out is that a couple of superdelegates come out, and then the election happens, and then the election pushes Barack Obama over the top, and then, hey, you know, here I am, and it was the people who did it. You know, there's that broad perception that it was the people. So, number one, she's establishing her credentials as a solid politician, whether it's for 2012, whether it's for 2018, whether it's for, you know, for whatever. And hopefully that can be used to, for example, challenge the leadership of the Senate. Let's say that in other words, Harry Reid, if this is the option one part. Option two is she's running for vice president. We'll get to that in a second. But that she is establishing those credentials so that she will have more political power. More, you know, what George W. Bush refers to as political capital. He said he wanted to invade Iraq so he'd have political capital. So he could get done everything I want to get done. Like privatizing Social Security and all of the kind of nasty stuff. So, and by the way, just a reminder, Ted Kennedy's undergoing brain surgery right now. We should all, you know, hold some light around him, hold him in our prayers. So anyhow, she's doing this to get that political power in my opinion, to demonstrate that she has it. I don't think anybody is going to be able to deny now after this process, particularly if Barack Obama gets the nomination and if she gracefully acknowledges that, which it certainly seems is going to happen. And then aggressively and enthusiastically campaigns for him, then I don't think anybody is going to be able to deny that she will have eclipsed her husband as one of the most powerful Democratic politicians in the United States, period. And that puts her in a good position to win re-election in the state of New York. It puts her in a good position to win a position as the Senate Majority Leader. Even though she's just a junior senator, I believe. I mean, this is all to the good, I think, for her career. And frankly, as she's been moving in more and more of a progressive direction throughout the election, and I think that we saw that same thing happen with Howard Dean. It was particularly fascinating for me to watch him because I'd lived in Vermont all those years and had a pretty good sense of Howard Dean and watched him and his brother Jim now, who I actually know fairly well, move from, I don't know where Jim's politics were in the beginning. I met him after Howard had run for president, but move from being basically a centrist Democrat, a corporatist Democrat, a Republican light Democrat, to becoming a progressive, a relatively progressive Democrat. So here we have, you know, a relatively progressive Democrat becoming one of the most, and a woman becoming one of the most powerful politicians in America. This is a great victory. Even if she doesn't secure the presidential nomination. So number one. Number two, is Hillary Clinton running for vice president? If that's is that what this is all about? Is it that she wants a place in the ticket? I wrote an op-ed a couple weeks ago where I said, you know, Barack, offer it to her, even if you have an agreement with her not to take it, even if you're asking her not to take it and she's agreeing not to take it, or even if she's saying she doesn't want it. Although, you know, I've heard from a number of people, these so-called insiders who say, well, you know, she doesn't really want it. She doesn't want the vice president. I don't believe it. I just do not believe it. Name one 19th century senator or 18th century senator. People don't remember people who are senators. People don't remember people who are members of the House of Representatives. People don't remember that, you know, John Quincy Adams was also a member of the House of Representatives, or that James Madison was also a member of the they don't. What they remember are the presidents and, to a lesser extent, the vice presidents. Those are the names that get carved in the granite of the national memory. Plus, if she's the vice president and Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have a successful presidency and vice presidency for 8 years, she will not be too old to run in 2016 for president. So I just, you know, anybody who says Hillary Clinton is not interested in the vice presidency, I think is just plain old flat out wrong. And personally, I think it would be a strong ticket because, and I understand the argument that he's representing change and she's representing the old way things are done in Washington. And to some extent, there's a certain amount of truth to that. He's getting most of his money from the internet. He's getting it from small donors. He's energizing young people and bringing people who haven't been in the process into the process. I would say she is as well, to a large extent, perhaps different people, a different demographic, but she's bringing people in as well. And to the extent that she represents the old politics, I would say that that is fading out. That's going away. And more she's reaching out through networks and to people. I don't see, number one, I don't see her being on the ticket as an anti-change, as turning it into an anti-change ticket, or as somehow destroying Obama's credibility as a change guy. Number one. And number two, think of how a vice presidential position during a campaign is usually played out. The vice president, the vice presidency, the candidate for vice president is the person who is supposed to go out there and take names and kick ass. That's what John Edwards failed to do to a large extent in the 2004 election. He did a pretty good job of campaigning, but his message was a message of hope. His message was a message of idealism. His message was a message of change and transformation. John Edwards was giving the message that should have been at the top of the ticket in the 2004 election that John Kerry was doing a relatively ineffective job of articulating simply because he's relatively inarticulate. Nonetheless, you go back and you look at what happened in Ohio, and I'm convinced that the election was stolen from them in Ohio. But you know, I believe that they won the presidency, just like I believe in 2000 that the presidency in Florida was, stolen from Al Gore by the Supreme Court. But nonetheless, an ideal person to have as your running mate is somebody who's going to take names and kick butt. And Hillary Clinton has demonstrated the ability to do that. She is one tough fighter. She is a great campaigner. Now, on the other hand, there's a lot of other people out there who'd make great vice presidential candidates as well. Bill Richardson would make a great vice presidential candidate. Joe Biden would make a great vice presidential candidate. I've heard all this talk about Chuck Hagel. I think it's a huge mistake to even think of putting Chuck Hagel on the ticket. The guy is a conservative Republican, period. Chris Dodd would be a good addition to the ticket. There are a number of people who could make John Edwards, obviously, a strong addition to the ticket. So, let's see how this thing shakes out. But I have a feeling that by the end of the day tomorrow, you're going to have Barack Obama as the nominee and Hillary Clinton solidly as one of the most powerful politicians in the United States, whether or not she's in the vice presidential position. And the Democratic Party coming together. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
This thing is coming to an end, I'll tell you that. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And, boy, crazy stuff going on in the world. I got to tell you, it is just, we're talking totally nuts. Pastor Hagee, I'm even reluctant to call him Pastor Hagee, but what the heck. Okay, Pastor Hagee, he says the Antichrist is coming. He's gay. He's partially Jewish. As was Adolf Hitler, and Joe Lieberman is still going to be the keynote speaker at this guy's conference. This is Pastor Hagee.
First, he has fierce features. The Antichrist is going to make Hitler look like a choir boy. When he first comes to power, he's going to slaughter one-third of the earth's population. He will become a blasphemer and a homosexual. This phrase that I'm using in Scripture, the God of his fathers, is a phrase in Scripture used solely to identify the Jewish people. It suggests that this man is at least going to be partially Jewish.
He continues to say, as I cut that too short, as was Hitler, as was Karl Marx, etc., as is Joe Lieberman. Come on, Joe! Wake up! There are crazies out there! They've taken over the right! They are the right! They're friggin' nuts! And this is why it's so important. It is so important. The next president is going to nominate probably three members of the Supreme Court. You have John Paul Stevens, who's 88 years old or 87 years old. You've got Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's in her late 70s and has had cancer and there are indications she would like to retire. And there is a lot of talk that David Souter is over it. He's tired of the crazies. He's tired of putting up with Scalia and Thomas and now, you know, the whole bunch. And he would love to just go back to New Hampshire and sit in his house and, you know, sit on the rocking porch. Three Supreme Court justices. You want them nominated by John McCain? 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, Guy in Hollywood, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Guy.
Yeah, actually, I'm in Hollywood, Florida.
Sorry about that.
No, actually, I wanted to compliment you. Your line of thinking is a refreshing change from a lot of the talk show hosts out there that are always ready to slam Hillary. And you know, in lieu of, there's two things I wanted to mention. One, in her situation, look at Huckabee. I mean, nobody blamed him, and she has a much more bona fide reason for running. The second thing that I wanted to point out that I think a lot of people miss is, you know, the mess, and you know yourself from all your travels overseas, the mess that the Bush administration has left us in with foreign policy. We desperately need the ability of a Bill Clinton in the diplomat position that can square off with world leaders. I think that's a tremendous asset that she would be bringing to the table. And I do believe that the dream ticket would be her as vice president. And I don't buy off on any of that baloney about her. She's with old politics. I mean, anybody that gets in there now is going to understand the importance of changing almost everything.
Things have changed. Times have changed. The national zeitgeist is different. And politicians change. I mean, it's just that simple. And in fact, it's what we want. I mean, if you say, oh, we want a politician who always says the same thing. I don't want a politician who always says the same thing. If we, the people, say, no, go this way instead of that way, I want them to go this way.
Exactly. One other very important thing I want to, if I may, mention, because it was in reference to the guest you had on earlier about a book, I think, about Bush.
I think
the whole gist of his book is giving way too much credit, and I didn't hear the whole interview, but that Bush is not corrupt. I think, and John Cusack's new film, which I haven't seen yet, but
it's,
I think,
great.
Speaks loudly about it, about there's no way I'm going to give this guy credit for having his motivation to be democratizing the Middle East. I think the motivation was much more corporatized, and I do. One of my fears is, Tom, that if we don't bring him accountable, if we don't eventually do impeachment, or if he doesn't face the music, I think all America is going to suffer. I think it makes the jihadists that are targeting the U.S. to come here, I think it's going to justify in their mind all these hundreds of thousands of Iraqis that have been brought to death by what Bush has done. And it's the old saying, like when your old man teaches you, you know, if you don't face the music on something, life has a way of bringing the reckoning around to you.
Yeah, it's called karma. Good point, Guy. Absolutely. Although I think that it's going to be more like Pinochet, frankly. I have a feeling that 5-10 years from now, maybe 2-3 years from now, we're going to see war crimes trials for George Bush and his cronies. And that's why people like Scott McClellan, and part of the reason why they are running as fast as they can. Alex in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Alex, we just have about a half a minute here before the break at the bottom.
That's fine. I just wanted to comment on the fact that I have every respect for Hillary Clinton, and I just wanted to note that I am a woman. I wanted to make sure that everybody understood that Barack is not necessarily it's not that he couldn't actually be a tough fighter, but against Hillary as an opponent, it came across really negative. It would come across negative for him, and it would actually backfire against him if he was actually too.
Right, but when he takes on McCain, he comes on really strong.
Well, McCain is a Republican. He
can
get away with it.
Right. And so Barack, I think he's doing it right. He's doing it right.
Exactly. But Democrats can't attack each other that way and then not backfire on him, especially him being a black man.
Yeah. Well, I'm not so sure that that's the factor. I think it's more that...
I do think so, though.
I'm sure, Alex, I'll grant you, and her being a woman, that that does play some small role in it. But I think the big issue is Democrat against Democrat. It just it gives everybody the creeps.
Yeah.
Alex, thank you very much for the call. Democrat against Republican? Yeah, that's the way it's supposed to be. Pick on them. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at
6-6-3-0-3-22-70. Change in this country. Radical, dramatic, significant, meaningful change. 30 years of Reaganism, right-wing economics. Yes, I know Bill Clinton in 1992 ran as a progressive, but governed as a centrist, as a light Republican. And it is time to roll all that stuff back. The whole NAFTA thing, let's reimpose tariffs. Let's go back to a system that protects our domestic industries. Let's protect our economy. Let's solidify our dollar. Let's even consider the gold standard. Let's do the things necessary to rebuild America. We've got trillions of dollars worth of infrastructure that's disintegrating in large part, again, because libertarian right-wing philosophy that says, no, government has no role in that. Private corporations should own our sewer systems and our roads and our highways and our bridges. Yeah, right. Put the profit motive in it. That's all you have to do. Have you seen these wonderful little graphics? They show them on TV. Where does that $130 go in a barrel of oil? Well, let's see. There's $17 in refining, and there's $26 in extracting. And they break it all out. I'm just pulling numbers out of the air here. And they break it all out. And nowhere does it ever say, and profit is... Amazing. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, I enjoyed your interview there with Pat Buchanan.
Thank you.
And believe it or not, I have a good deal of respect for both of you. And I do think, I just glanced through Pat's book in the bookstore, and I think, although he probably meant well, I think at bottom, you know, it's pretty naive to think that if Britain hadn't declared war against Germany, that Hitler would have been easier to deal with. But I do think he's onto something. And, you know, I think a lot of times he's accused of being a nationalist perhaps, or even racist. Mm-hmm. But I think he's got something when he talks about the European culture in this sense, the political culture. I mean, there's a tradition that goes all the way back to the Magna Carta in England, which built on from there up to our revolution, of course, and going forward, of human rights and so forth, that you just didn't see, for instance, in Africa or in Asia. What say you?
Well, what I say is that in 19, I believe it was 87, it might have been 89, when in Beijing, China, the students, 15,000 students, marched into Tiananmen Square carrying a 36-foot-tall papier-mâché statue of the, or replica of the Statue of Liberty, renaming her Lady Liberty. They were quoting Jefferson. They were talking about the Magna Carta.
But that's the point. It's that European mindset that other peoples follow all over the world.
Well, it may be that, you know, that piece of it, Europeans began. I would say that there's a lot to be said for Gandhi in India and some of the ideals that he pursued, which were not necessarily European, and many of the nonviolent movements that have come out of the East, out of Buddhism.
Right.
I think that there is a lot of good in a lot of cultures, and that to say, oh, hey, it's our culture. This is the culture of white European English-speaking peoples, and therefore it's the only decent one. I mean, look at what the Swedes have done with it. Look what, you know, around the world. Let's try to let Actually, the problem with the let's try to part is exactly what Buchanan is pointing out in his book and what...
Okay, but let me ask you this, Tom. Is there anything wrong, just as Asian people are proud of their culture and Africans are proud of theirs, it almost seems like some progressives are afraid to say that the white European culture is something worth preserving? I don't think there's anything to be... Well, there's certainly some things to be ashamed of, but what I'm saying is, by and large, the white European culture has been a benefit to mankind, I believe.
In many ways and in many regards. At the same time, it has been responsible for death and destruction on an unparalleled scale.
Well,
I know of no cultures in history that have had the kinds of wars that white Europeans have had.
But let's remember that Hitler wasn't exactly indicative of the rest of Europe.
No, but if it hadn't been Hitler, it might well have been somebody else. I mean, it's just, case in point. I mean, you know, because Stalin was killing his own people.
Look at Mao.
Sure, he was a terrible guy, and he killed a lot of people. I'm not saying that I am ashamed of white European culture.
No, I didn't say you were, but I think some progressives are.
I think it's more a matter of saying, you know, one of the subtexts of Pat's book that made me very uncomfortable is the idea that Britain, by surrendering empire, by letting go of Uganda, by letting go of South Africa, by letting go of, you know, I mean, fill in the blanks, by letting go of all these countries, was making the world a less stable and more dangerous place.
Right.
And if you believe that, then the corollary to that is that America should be empire. And I don't get how... The thing that fundamentally confuses me in Buchanan's book, and by and large, and not just Buchanan, but let's just, you know, take this out of there, because again, he's not here to defend himself or speak for himself, and I certainly can't. But what confuses me is the idea that we should praise Imperial Britain and condemn Imperial America.
I agree. Pat does seem to have that mindset, doesn't he?
It doesn't make sense. You can't have it both ways.
You know what I think his problem is? He's never been quite able, even though he left the Republican Party, he's never been able to completely divorce himself. He condemned the war, but yet he endorsed Bush last time around. He seems to be kind of double-minded there, and he can't decide what he wants to be.
Yeah. Well, again, good point, Rick, and thank you for the call. I'm not going to try and psychoanalyze Pat Buchanan, but it is thought-provoking. Let's just leave it at that. Dan in San Diego. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind?
Yeah, a couple points about Pat Buchanan, and, you know, basically what he does is he cherry picks and conflates, you know, in talking about culture.
Name a historian who doesn't.
Pardon?
Name a historian who doesn't. I mean, that's more the norm.
But what he did, he talked about Mexicans and says that Chavez being a cultural icon as opposed to Shakespeare, blah, blah, blah. And
but Cesar Chavez was an American.
Yeah, that's my point. He conflated Chavez with Mexican nationals and immigration when, in fact, Chavez was American.
Chavez led a march from the San Joaquin Valley to the border of Mexico to protest illegal immigration into the United States.
Yeah, that was my point. And the second point was he talked about the growth of non-white population outstripping that of the white population. And that has more to do with socioeconomic factors, and Buchanan's solution is to demonize the non-white population when the better solution would be to remove the barriers that are in the way of the non-white populations, you know, having opportunities for moving higher on the socioeconomic ladder.
Yeah. You know, Jefferson in his diary wrote about how much he admired the Native American cultures and suggested that perhaps Europeans should intermarry with them and that we should be learning more from their culture and assimilating pieces of it. I think that idea of finding cultures that work and let's be a little scientific. Let's be a little pragmatic about it. Dan, thanks for the call and bringing it into what we're doing. Jeannie, is it Jeannie in Ithaca, New York?
Yeah.
Listening on WNYY. Hey, Jeannie, what's up?
Yes. Hi, I would like to talk about Hillary a little bit.
Sure.
I usually agree with everything you have to say, Tom, but in this case, I disagree. I think she her war vote originally in Iraq was, well, it was either pandering or really bad judgment, and both of those are just unacceptable for a vice presidential candidate, and her vote on Iran, and her vote for cluster bombs. She seems too hawkish to me.
Yeah. Well, she in all of those regards, she's too hawkish for me as well. And
I have one question for you.
I think it's possible.
Are
for
you
to
in promotion of this just to bring the party together?
In part, you know, first of all, I'm not promoting it.
Right.
You know, if Barack Obama picks, you know, any, I mean, there's a whole bunch of highly qualified people out there. I'm not trying to promote Hillary Clinton as vice president. My point was, I think she's running for vice president.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a case to be made for it. And I think if he chooses her for vice president, it won't be a mistake. That's my point. It's not that I'm some big advocate for it, but,
I was just thinking that there are a bunch of other people, even say maybe some people who were on her side who he could pick. Another woman would bring
in. Yeah, Sebelius, for example. But then it looks like he's being gratuitous. And really, I'm not sure that Kathleen Sebelius has earned a spot on the ticket as VP, although you could argue that most VPs don't. I mean, you know, they're picked for strategic reasons. You know, what did Dan Quayle do to earn?
Yeah, really.
So. But anyhow, thanks a lot for the call, Jeannie. It's an interesting point. Harvey in Columbia, South Carolina. We got a minute before the break, Harvey. What's up?
Well, I figured it would be a minute before the break.
No, it's we have hard breaks on this show. They come in, you know.
Frankly, I hope Hillary don't get on the ticket with Barack because he's going to lose, and that will diminish her stature. She'd be in the loser's column like John Kerry and
You think her being on the ticket is going to cause him to lose, or you think he's going to lose no matter what and she'll go down with him?
People don't vote for the VP. They vote for the president. She won't be a great hit.
But they also very often vote against people. And if she does a good job as a vice – or anybody, if the vice presidential nominee is good at attacking John McCain, then that's going to help Obama. Yeah.
If the Democrat don't carry – and listen to this. If the Democrat don't carry Florida, Ohio, and West Virginia, that's not R, that's and, then we can hang it up.
Yeah, but just because Barack Obama didn't win those against Hillary Clinton doesn't mean he can't win them against John McCain.
I mean, it's different from the general election.
That's my point.
Well, you can't compare him running against Hillary against him running against John McCain.
No, I can't. That's my point. I think that he can win those states, even though Hillary won those states, and I don't think that she has to be on the ticket for him to win those states. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Down the road I go, hanging memories on the highline poles. Free and easy down the road I go, free and easy down the road I go.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Columbia. Find out more at Teamsters.org. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
What's up in the world today? Oh, well, by the way, before we get started, is there going to be a radio row at the Talkers Convention on Friday? Do you know?
I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I wish I could tell you.
All righty, because I know I'll be doing the show Thursday from the UN with you guys, and I thought maybe Friday I would be as well. So in any case, okay, back to business. What's going on in the world?
Well, I have to tell you that I discovered this morning, I get to work very early, about 3:45, and I open my email, and there was a generally incoherent email from Ellen that told me I was on page 2, and I emailed her back and said, what are you talking about, Ellen? She said, you're on page 2 of Scott's book.
Oh, really? Scott McClellan's book?
Yes.
Ah!
So finally, some kind of recognition. I'm on in Scott McClellan's book.
Now, does it have to do with... you know what?
Valerie Plame and Karl Rove.
Is it criminal cover-ups or is it whipped cream? I mean, you know, what is it?
Well, I haven't seen it. I've been going all around the bookshops trying to get a copy, and they're all sold out. But basically, I think it has to do with the fact that I asked the key question.
You know, sometimes that's interesting. Sometimes Amazon will publish the first 4 or 5 pages of a book online. You might want to check Amazon.com and see.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
that's
they've
very
got
interesting.
Most of my books, they have the first 5 or 10 pages, you know, right there online. You can read them. So.
Oh, cool. Because yeah. I want to know whether he just says, you know, Victoria Jones asked a question, or whether he wants to say that you know, scumbucket left-wing Victoria Jones asked the question.
Okay, well, you know, tell us what's going on in the world, and I'll see if I can track it down while we're on the air here.
Well, I attended the briefing with Dana Perino today, and Prime Minister Olmert of Israel is coming into town, and a lot of the questions had to do with the fact of, well, is he really relevant? I mean, is he going to have a gig in a couple of weeks' time, or what?
The Prime Minister of Israel, you mean?
Prime Minister Olmert, basically.
Yeah.
Is he going to be able to hold on his job? What is the point of even talking about the peace process, considering that he may not even have a job? That seemed to be the key question, but he and the president will be meeting to talk about the peace process, and which is, of course, stumbling, as we all know. That came up. I asked a question about rendition. I'm sure you saw the report in The Guardian about how prison ships are apparently being used to house people. And so I asked about the fact that the human rights organization Reprieve states that at least 200 people have been used in rendition since 2006, when President Bush said the practice had been stopped. And I asked her to confirm this, and she said she'd never heard of the organization Reprieve and referred me to the CIA, so I didn't get an answer to that question.
Amazing. Let me read to you from Scott McClellan's book, Put Your Curiosity to Rest. This is from Scott McClellan's What Happened. For nearly 2 weeks following the September 29 disclosure of a criminal investigation by the Department of Justice, I vigorously pushed back at the notion that the White House was behind the leak. Even before then, I had batted down any suggestion that my colleague and fellow Texan Karl Rove, a frequent target of our critics as the president's closest advisor, was involved in the leak. Later, I added the vice president's chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, to the list of those I defended. By the daily White House briefing on October 10th, I was looking for a way to extricate myself from commenting any further about specifics of the Plame case, which were now part of the recently announced investigation. The opening I sought came near the end of that Friday's briefing in the form of a question from Victoria Jones, a cordial yet skeptical liberal talk radio journalist and Bush administration critic. Quote, Scott, Jones said, earlier this week, you told us that neither Karl Rove, Elliot Abrams, nor Louis Libby disclosed any classified information with regard to the leak. I wonder if you could tell us more specifically whether any of them told any reporter that Valerie Plame worked for the CIA, end quote. I was ready with a reply. Quote, I spoke with those individuals, as I pointed out, and those individuals assured me that they were not involved in this, I said, and that's where it stands, period. And then he goes on to another reporter, and the story continues. So that's Victoria Jones and Scott McClellan's book.
A cordial yet skeptical liberal White House critic.
Yeah, Bush administration critic, yes.
Bush administration critic.
A cordial yet skeptical liberal talk radio journalist and Bush administration critic. You
it's
are,
not entirely inaccurate, is it, really?
No, it's not. And you're famous. How about
that's
that?
That's a hoot. Well, yeah. Not as famous as you, Tom, because you've actually written these things. I've just been in one.
Well, here we are. So, anyhow, what else is going on in the world, Victoria?
Well, other than that, one of the things that is really going on in the world, quite frankly, is what exactly is going on with the Democratic Party. It's really very much being talked about in Washington, and whether they're going to be able to recover from the split between the Obamians and the Clintonites, and that really this race is coming down to gender versus race.
Do you think that that's a core cleavage, or that's simply what's going on the fringe?
I think it's what's going on the fringe. I think what's going on at the heart is pure politics of power.
Mm-hmm. See, I'm not sure that there is. I think that there is a vocal minority within those two groups, women and African Americans, who are voting gender or race, but I think that they're relatively insignificant compared to the number of people who are voting based on the belief that this is the right candidate. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the other is the wrong candidate. In other words, I think that the Democrats are going to come together. Are you of the opinion that they're not? Is that the bottom line here?
I'm of the opinion that there are enough that may not come together that it could be difficult for them. I'm of the opinion it's all down to her.
Yeah.
If she's lukewarm, then it's all over.
Yeah. The most important person in this race right now is Hillary Clinton, because if she does not aggressively support Barack Obama, assuming that he wins the nomination tomorrow, if she does not aggressively support him, I agree with you. John McCain will be our next president, and that will be a disaster. Victoria Jones, the famous Victoria Jones, found on page 2 of Scott McClellan's new book, What Happened? The incredibly famous Victoria Jones. We'll talk radio news service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria, for gracing us with your famous presence.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Great talking with you. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, the No Boring Zone.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
Your home for truth in broadcasting.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And soon our national, long national nightmare will be over. January 20th, 2009. George W. Bush will voluntarily leave office. Or at least we hope he will. We expect him to. He showed up at the National Spelling Bee. Jessica Shakespeare, an 11-year-old from West Virginia, one of the Spelling Bee finalists, was asked, can President Bush spell constitutional? She said, no, don't think so. Raymond Soriano, 14, Spelling Bee contestant from Texas, says, Bush misspelled business one time. That's embarrassing. Vincent Medina from Florida, 11-year-old Vincent Medina. This is the National Spelling Bee Championship, right? He says, anyone can outspell Bush. And Jonathan Shute, a 13-year-old from Canada, thinks he can outspell Dick Cheney and Condoleezza, too. Yeah. Oh, man. I mean, it's at a certain level, it's just downright embarrassing what's going on. And Colin, you might want to let Marcus know that line 10 have been ringing there for a while. So, in any case, we'll see how it all shakes out. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Sherry in Northern California, listening on Green 960. Hey, Sherry, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I truly trust what you say. I have enormous admiration and respect for you, and I have a question for you.
Okay.
Why is it that in talking about Scott McClellan's book, the media talk only discusses that they discredit Scott McClellan, and I've never heard any of the content of the book discredited.
Because apparently the content of the book is unimpeachable. The corporate media in America doesn't want to talk about the content because the content largely indicts the media even more than it indicts the administration. You know, the very first day there were those quotes, and then there were a couple of commentators that came out and said something. Jessica Yellen with CNN. She's now posted a formal apology on their website. You know, Andrea Mitchell made a comment. They were very quick to cover that up. Frankly, the corporate media in America is not a fan of introspection and not fond of criticism. So that's my take on it.
No, it's the person who writes it and not having anything to do with what he says.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all about character assassination.
That's
and personal
very
attack.
Discouraging. Okay, well, thank you, Tom.
You're welcome. Sherry, thanks a lot for the call. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hey, a couple things. One is as far as what Victoria just said about voting for a black person or voting for a woman.
Mm-hmm.
People can still do that. They can vote for a black woman. Cynthia McKinney's running. I'm not endorsing her, but I'm just saying, there is a liberal woman running for president right
now. Yeah, she doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell, as they say.
But I'd sure rather have people, if people don't want to vote for Obama, but yeah, the Hillary people, I'd say, hey, don't vote for McCain, at least vote for Cynthia.
I'd say vote for the Democrat and make a commitment to show up at the local Democratic Party and get involved and take that thing over.
And as far as the thing of the decision this weekend about Florida and Michigan, If I decided to vote for president today, would my vote count? Because I just don't want to wait.
What do you mean?
I think I should be able to vote whenever I want for president. Yeah, rather than wait till November, I should be able to cast my vote today and have it count. You know, there are rules. You get to vote in certain times of the year.
Right. Well, that has to do with the fact that that's when the parties have come up with the candidates, and the candidates have had their candidacies, and people have campaigned and things like that. So.
Yeah, but I don't get to decide when I'm going to vote. I have to wait till November.
No, it's in the Constitution.
Yeah, and so if I vote today, my vote won't count.
Well, actually, today it probably won't, but most states have early voting, you know, vote by mail, things like that.
Yeah, but there are rules when you get to vote.
I'm missing your point, Jeff.
Well, the point is that Florida and Michigan didn't follow the rules.
Oh, I see.
And so it's like, you know, we don't just get to choose.
Right, right. And they've been penalized for that appropriately. So, Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Richard Clark is with us. Yes, that Richard Clark, the Richard Clark who began his career in the Office of the Secretary of Defense in 1973. He was Deputy Secretary of Intelligence in the Reagan administration. The Senate confirmed him as Assistant Secretary of State for Political and Military Affairs in the George Herbert Walker Bush administration. Served in the White House for both Bush 1 and Clinton. Now he teaches at the Harvard Kennedy School, and consults for ABC News, and is chairman of Good Harbor Consulting, which is goodharbor.net on the website, on the web. He has a new book out, Your Government Failed You, Breaking the Cycle of National Security Disasters. Richard Clark, welcome back to our program.
No, it's good to be with you.
Thank you. Before we get to the book, I'm just curious your take on the current state of the presidential election, both the Democratic and Republican candidates, and what's going on.
Well, I hope the Democratic candidate will emerge sometime this week, if not tomorrow night on Wednesday, so that we can have a real two-candidate campaign and have some real debates. I think it's going to be fascinating to watch these debates because it'll be a real contrast of old and new. And I think the opinion polls that show it's basically a tie now will change, I think, dramatically.
Yeah. In your book, your government failed you. You know, that very premise, the underlying premise behind that statement is that your government is here to serve you, which is is supposed to accomplish something, which is kind of antithetical to the libertarian and the libertarian streak within the Republican worldview. To what extent are the failures that led to 9/11 and many of the other failures that you document in your book, to what extent are those the consequence of an ideology that government really shouldn't do anything other than fight foreign wars?
Well, I think there's an ideology prevalent in the Republican Party and in parts of Washington that government should not regulate, that it should basically let the corporate world do what it wants.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have these instances such as the mortgage meltdown where the government didn't regulate.
Right.
And numerous
they deregulated.
Right, right. They gave up the regulation. Right. Numerous examples of where an industry will push back on the government and say, well, we don't want to do that security thing that you want us to do. And therefore the government says, okay, well, fine, if you don't want to do it. Prior to 9/11, that was the airline industry. And the airline industry pushed back hard on a whole series of proposals for improving security of passenger airlines.
Right, back in the 70s when they were hijacking planes to Cuba.
All the way through the 90s. You know, there was an Al Gore Charity Commission in 1997, I believe, on aviation security, and came up with some ideas, and the industry said, oh, no, we can't do that. It's much worse in the Bush administration, where they've actually appointed people who are commissioners of various regulatory agencies who avowedly don't want to regulate and haven't even used the authority that the regulatory commissions already have, let alone asked for new ones.
Mm-hmm. So, first of all, we're talking with Richard Clark. The title of the book, Your Government Failed You, Breaking the Cycle of National Security Disasters. The national security disaster cycle here, when did this begin? What is the nature of it? And how do we break that cycle?
Well, I think it's been going on. Probably there have been national security failures for the last 30 years. But I think it's certainly picked up enormously in the last decade. And part of what's going on here is the politicization of national security, where every time an issue comes up, the Democrats and the Republicans seek to differentiate themselves from each other over that issue, even if it's a national security issue, rather than asking what's the right response. A rare instance where this didn't happen last week was where the three presidential candidates issued a joint statement on Darfur and Sudan.
Right.
But that's extraordinarily rare. Typically, they immediately try to find a wedge, turn a security problem into a political wedge issue, try to scare us into voting one way or the other.
You know, I'm surprised by how much the Democrats have not done that with 9/11. It would have been, I can just imagine if Bill Clinton had been president and a 9/11 happened, Newt Gingrich would have been on him so hard, so fast. You let this happen. This is all your fault. No Democrat ever said that about George Bush.
No, I think the Democrats have made some strategic mistakes about national security issues and ceded the field in many ways in terms of reputation to the Republicans. And I write in the book about how military families, families of military retirees or families of people who have some member active duty in the Army, overwhelmingly seem to vote Republican, even though the man from Mars, the fair observer looking at the performance of the Bush administration, would say that this Republican administration has been terrible for military families and military personnel.
Right, whereas the Democratic administration that fought World War II won the war and provided for the GIs afterwards.
Yeah, and we have this administration that not only didn't provide body armor for the soldiers, didn't send in enough troops, didn't provide armored vehicles for them, and then when they come back wounded and with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, doesn't have a medical system ready to support them.
Right.
And then when someone proposes a GI Bill expansion to compensate them, the White House and John McCain oppose it. So it's incredible that military families will knee-jerk and say the Republicans are better for on military issues and national security issues, despite the overwhelming facts that the Republicans have hurt military families and military personnel.
I think that's changing rapidly. We're talking with Richard Harbor, Richard Clark. GoodHarbor.net is his website. The new book, Your Government Failed You, Breaking the Cycle of National Security Disasters. Sir, we have about a half a minute left. Just in a very in a capsule, what should Americans do about this?
Well, I think they should call foul when people like John McCain try to politicize these things in an overt way, saying that Barack Obama is the candidate for Hamas, you know, that sort of thing. It's just unacceptable, and people ought to scream and yell bloody murder when they do it.
Yeah, and just call them out on it.
Exactly.
Well said. Richard Clark, good luck with the book, and thank you for the great work that you've done helping us defend our nation and now highlighting many of the ways that we can do so better in the future. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
17 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman.
Joining the fight by taking on the right.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Three minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting live, coast to coast, border to border. Welcome back. Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz is with us, representing the state of Florida. And, hey, Congresswoman, welcome.
Thank you very much, Tom. Good to be here.
Thank you. How do you see this whole situation, the electoral situation, playing out?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we'll obviously have these primaries tomorrow. We have to see what the outcome of those are.
I think that it will be pretty clear that Senator Clinton is ahead in the popular vote when the primaries conclude tomorrow, and Senator Obama will be ahead in pledged delegates. And, you know, there'll need to be some soul-searching and some conversations that we'll have over, that will be had over the next several days and perhaps a little bit longer than that. And so it's a little bit early to predict what's going to happen.
How deep do you think the wounds have gone in the Democratic Party as a result of?
How deep do I think the wounds? You know, yeah. I really think they're surface wounds. I think, you know, there are superficial wounds that you always have when you have a primary. But I personally don't think this primary has been any more divisive. Actually, I think it's been less divisive than most primaries that I've observed. And because we have so much at stake in this general election coming up, I absolutely believe we will come together as a party. Now, will we have some obstacles to get over? You know, particularly in my state after Saturday's decision, yes, we definitely will.
Yeah.
But I think they are surmountable obstacles.
What are your thoughts on what happened with regard to the 50-50 split of?
I think it was an irresponsible decision. I mean, I think it was irresponsible and it wasn't very strategic. I mean, Florida is the biggest swing state in the general election, and you know, there are a lot of hard feelings. I can tell you I've gotten a lot of contact emails and phone calls and people who are very disappointed and, who are saying, listen, they don't want half of us to come out to vote in the general election, and they certainly don't want only half of our money. So they're pretty resentful of the fact that they've only given us half a vote. And hopefully what will happen is that whoever the Democratic nominee is will very quickly move to restore our full delegation and give us a full vote at the convention.
Does the nominee have that ability?
The nominee has the ability because they can go to either the Rules or the Credentials Committee and ask that they meet again and vote to seat the delegation.
Hmm,
I think that will be essential.
Yeah. The Republicans cut their delegate vote in half as well. And I haven't heard any Republicans complaining about this. It isn't really the issue here that
well, the Republicans have had a nominee for, a presumptive nominee for a while. And so the impact is not the same. And I would expect that the Republican, that John McCain will make sure that the Florida delegation and the Republican Party is seated in full as well.
Yeah. So, okay. So then the reason in your mind that that people are concerned about this is because basically it's making it possible for Barack Obama to become the nominee over the next couple of days. I mean, isn't that the bottom line?
The reason it's important is that we have to make sure that whoever the nominee is, that they don't go into the general election with one hand tied behind their back. And if you are automatically, putting yourself in a situation where you have to get over, some majorly, not just hurt feelings, but some resentment that's been created by the mistreatment, which is perceived down here by the DNC.
But isn't your rhetoric
is really the only one that can heal that?
Isn't your rhetoric, maintaining or exacerbating that?
I'm sorry.
Isn't when you say that? Well, we're out of time. I'm sorry. We've hit the bottom of the hour. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, I thank you very much for coming on the program.
You're welcome.
And
thanks
for the great job you're doing representing Florida. Good talking to you. 26 minutes past the hour. Telephone number 866-303-2270. TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com if you want more information. And drop into our live chat room. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Here comes the rest.
Just a day too early, Maybe it's just 2 days too early. I don't know. We'll see. But Hang on a second. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, of course, a partisan for the Clinton campaign for president. And the point in my mind is that the most important person in this race between Obama and Clinton right now is going to be the loser. And all the indications are that that loser is going to be Hillary Clinton. In fact, it's being reported right now. She's heading back to New York. She's asking her campaign staff to turn in their expenses. I mean, these are all the kinds of things that you do when you're wrapping up a campaign. And how she comports herself, how she handles this, how she deals with it, what she says, and what she has her surrogates say is going to decide whether this country is torn apart, or at least the Democratic Party, is torn apart or moves forward. And it concerns me to hear surrogates for the Clinton campaign talk about they don't mind taking all of their money from Florida, but they're only getting them half the vote. You know, that kind of rhetoric. I mean, that it's essentially combative stuff. It frankly concerns me. We were very, very short on time in that segment, and I don't want to get into something really adversarial with a member of Congress who's, I think, trying to do the right thing and support her candidate. But it is time to start healing. Chris in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, listening on Wind. Say, Chris.
Yeah, hey, Tom. Actually, that's the beauty of Barack Obama's candidacy is that the people with money can't influence him. And that's kind of what a lot of those of us who've kind of sided with Obama, I didn't start out initially on his side, but once Edwards dropped by the wayside and others, he had two choices. And he, in my mind, was the best choice. Now, when I hear my elected officials down here, I'm right down here and see her on the TV all the time. I see this weekend as I'm watching the hearings, and I'm watching my Senator Bill Nelson get up there distorting the facts, saying that he's representing Florida. He's not representing Florida, nor is she. They're representing Hillary's supporters that feel disenfranchised. Nobody here in Florida is complaining. The majority of us didn't vote for her, and we knew it wasn't going to count. So for them to, you know, distort the facts and say so many people voted because of the primary, there was a huge tax incentive or issue that was on the ballot, and they didn't mention that until later in the hearings. He just ignored it. So, you know, the fact is there should be consequences when somebody's willing to put aside the party for blind, loyalty to a candidate. I think the voters should keep that in mind the next time re-elections come around for Wasserman Schultz, for Bill Nelson. There's a guy, I don't know if you heard this, one of the local Florida legislators says he's going to take this to court, this decision mm-hmm. to split the delegates. No matter whether Hillary steps aside or not, his name's Steve Geller.
Yeah.
He says he's going to take it to court no matter what. So they're going to continue to fight it in the Florida legislature.
Yeah, but that person is going to let it go. I think Chris that the Clinton campaign is going to do the right thing. I really do. I frankly I was surprised by what Congresswoman Schultz said, but I think that they're going to do the right thing. We'll see. We'll have to see. Thanks a lot for the call, though. I appreciate it. Listening on WNYY in New York, John in Ithaca. Hey, John, what's up?
Yes. Hello, Tom. Thank you. I've never called in before. Maybe I've never gotten through, but you are a wonderment. You're, thank goodness that you're on the radio.
Well, thank you. What's up?
You have such an equanimous feel about you. To listen to the Harold Ickes and the Deborah Wasserman Schultz threaten the Democratic Party, and in my mind, they're not only threatening the Democratic Party, they're threatening the future of this country, because we have never been in this kind of a debacle of a situation. 8 years has almost ruined us as a democracy.
Yeah, I'd say the closest we've come to it was during the administration of John Adams. With the Alien Sedition Acts,
I'm old, but I'm not that old.
Right, but I mean, he was putting into prison newspaper publishers for writing editorials against
him. And there's been threats of that here. You know, anybody against the war. We all know what's been done. We all know that Barack Obama, I believe, is the most capable of welding people together back together again. Hillary works more like an adversarial lawyer.
Right.
She wants to destroy the other side.
This is why she'd make, in my opinion, this is why she'd make a great vice presidential candidate.
Well, absolutely, but I disagree with you on that. I'd love to see a Jim Webb or a John Edwards, actually.
But see, Jim Webb.
I was an Edwards supporter.
Yeah,
and,
I was an Edwards supporter too. And Jim Webb has a number of problems. There's been an interesting chronicling of them over at, I believe, the Coase, maybe it was Huffington Post. But his biggest problem is the same problem that Barack Obama has. The same criticism has been leveled against him, which is he has 2 years of federal legislative experience.
Well, I just wanted to say one other thing that I forgot what it was.
That's okay. I know the feeling. It happens to me all the time.
The Deborah Wasserman Schultz and the Harold Ickes, their time is the past. They're operating on a mentality that's past. The future requires the change that Barack is talking about.
Yeah.
And I'm not 20 years old. I've seen a lot, and I still recognize that this is where we have to go.
Yeah. Yeah, this too shall pass, John. Trust me. It's like when Jefferson talked about, soon the age of witches shall pass. He was referring, of course, to John Adams and his administration, where Jefferson was the vice president and left town the day that Adams signed the Alien and Sedition Acts. The time of witches, speaking of George W. Bush and company, will pass. Mike in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, listening on WDTW. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom.
What's up?
A while back, I called you and I talked about the difference between winning and governing.
Yes.
And the strategies that will allow you to win makes it almost impossible for you to govern.
Not necessarily.
Well, I'm saying there's a certain type, and this is the type of politics that has been very pervasive over the last 20, 30 years. And if you look at the Democratic primary, it's the exact same template, the same model. It is to burn the town down, just burn it down, and then we'll worry about governing it later. So what really concerns me, and I respect you for one thing, cracking the code I got from you, and I have a complete understanding of language I didn't have before. So look at some factual information. Congressman Schultz, she basically said that Hillary Clinton is winning the popular vote. She's defining the popular vote in a very narrow way. She's excluding anyone that voted in a caucus, which for this whole trumpeting of let's count all the votes, let's make sure everyone has their franchise, they're disenfranchising everyone who's voted in
right.
the caucus.
No, it's I agree. It's a very disingenuous articulation, and I wish they wouldn't use it because even when they count those who, I think in most cases, they actually count the people who voted in the caucuses, but that doesn't mean that they're counting all the people who would have voted in the state had the state held a primary.
You may
have 500 or 1,000 people who show up for a caucus. You might have had 50,000 or 100,000 who would show up to vote, and if you proportionally spread that out, then, you've got a whole different story.
And the second piece is, if you look over time, Hillary Clinton had every opportunity to basically say that what happened in Florida and not counting these votes was wrong. She had the opportunity to do that when she signed the pledge saying that it wouldn't count. She had an opportunity all along the way. She chose to do that when it was politically to her benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to suggest that this somehow has anything to do with making sure people in Florida have a right to vote and their vote counted in the primary, it's not only disingenuous, it's a downright lie. And when Donna Brazile made the statement that when you change the rules at the end of the game, that is a simple way to look at that. It's called cheating. That is a fact. So when you were talking about healing the party, bringing us together, the Clinton strategy to govern is to do anything to win first, and then there's nothing left over to govern. And then the last thing I wanted to say from a language point of view, the media, and you guys have allowed this, we talk about the Clintons like they're one person. We talk about what happened in the 90s when the Clintons were in office. If that is true, then Barack Obama is running against Hillary, Bill Clinton, and John McCain. Then he's doing a great job.
Yeah, he's running against a large machine. And I think probably the biggest lesson to come out of what happened on Saturday is that Bill Clinton doesn't run the Democratic Party any longer.
But Hillary Clinton was not in the office in the 90s. And every time someone says the Clintons are great campaigners, when the Clintons were in office, they weren't. She's never been president. That's a fact.
Right. But she's been senator, and she's run and won two senatorial elections.
But we give her credit for the 90s, which is okay to do, but we talk about her campaign, and we say the Clintons, yeah, plural. The media has done this throughout the campaign. Mm. The Clintons did this. The Clintons have been very successful.
Oh,
the Clintons weren't in power in the 90s. That's not true.
Right, and it's usually the good rather than the bad. For example, you know, the Clintons passed NAFTA. The Clintons destroyed the middle class. The Clintons did welfare reform, which is throwing a lot of low-income women into poverty and homelessness. Yeah. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. We'll continue with our conversation. And we may be able to get Susie Turnbull in here. That would be fascinating. The number two person in the DNC. We'll check it out. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program right here on Air America.
Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Minutes before the hour. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman radio program. Slim possibility that Susie Turnbull, our old friend, we've had Susie on the program many, many times, will have an opportunity to call in. She's the she works with Howard Dean. She's number two in the DNC. But if not, we've got a whole bunch of callers here, and we've got about 4 minutes, four and a half minutes. So I'm just going to ask you to make a major point, and I will not pontificate at length, and we'll just click through the callers here. We'll make it really fast. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bernice.
Oh, hi, Tom. I listened very carefully to Hillary Clinton's victory speech from Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. I think she's determined to take this to the convention floor.
Yeah.
And if there should be a stalemate and a bloodbath, I can foresee John Edwards being chosen as a compromise.
That would be very interesting. I don't think she's going to take it to the convention floor, but I think she's trying to keep her candidacy sufficiently viable that if some huge stumble happens on the part of the Obama campaign, some Reverend Wright thing comes out or whatever, that she'll be there. Joan in Portland, Oregon on KPOJ. Hey, Joan.
Yes, Tom. I'm a Clinton supporter, and I do not think the party is going to come together in November. I, for one, a lifelong Democrat, will vote for John McCain.
Oh, I think that's tragic, Joan.
Well, I think it's sad the way
you want more people to die.
I think it's very sad the way it's a matter of principle, Tom. I think
so. You think that young men and women in Iraq and people in Iraq dying is your principle?
Well, Tom, when 50% of the American population, over 50%, is disenfranchised in a way, and our candidate is treated with an exceedingly obnoxious amount of sexism and unfairness by the media, including Air America Radio, then I think we have to stand on principle.
I'm so sorry to hear, Joan, that you're willing to have more people die, more human beings die,
Tom,
as a consequence
for
the way that you think that your candidate has been treated. And I would hope that that you're not including me in that, you say Air America Radio. Joan, I'm just very sorry to hear that. Susie Turnbull, the vice chair of the Democratic National Committee, convention, committee? Yeah.
Party.
The party.
The hey. Democratic Party.
Hey, Susie. Great to talk with you again.
Hi, Tom. Tom, I just heard the trail end. I heard the last comment, and I just want to tell a story that Governor Dean told the other day, which was during the 2004 campaign, he was attacked pretty viciously many, many times. And during that period, one night he was walking in his hotel room, like pacing, and Al Gore called him on the phone, and he said to Al, and he started complaining to Al Gore about what had happened and what was happening. This was prior to Iowa in 2004. And he was just really upset, and Al Gore stopped him and said, "This isn't about you, Howard. This is about our country." And I think what you just said, Tom, is exactly right. This isn't about one individual. This is about our country. It's not about either candidate. And what we need to do is to do exactly what you just said, is to think about what it would mean with a John McCain presidency. What does it mean to have another, have more troops die in Iraq and
or Iran,
war, or Iran with a war with no end? What does it mean to have gas prices escalating, home heating bills, which people haven't even started to think about from next fall? What does it mean to have people who vote against the minimum wage and vote against and would veto children's health?
Right.
If that's what people want, the way to do that is not to recognize that either of our candidates offers a different direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I was talking about people dying, I wasn't just talking about Iraq. The Republican policies have – we've done entire shows on this. The research that has been done that when conservative governments in the U.K. and Australia come into power, suicide goes up. In the United States with our dysfunctional healthcare system, we've got 15,000-20,000 minimum, small estimate. That was the Wall Street Journal's estimate of number of people who die as a result of our, of not being insured. People are dying because of Republican policies.
Right, and not dealing, for example, with the foreclosure crisis.
Right, and then McCain says he's going to appoint more people like Alito to the Supreme Court. You're going to end up with abortion recriminalized. And I'm old enough to remember a girl in high school. I didn't know her, well, but I knew who she was. Who one day just vanished. She wasn't there. What happened? Right. She got a back alley abortion. She got an infection, and she died 2 days later.
This is really serious. And Tom, as you know, I'm just coming back from a funeral for a dear friend of, and the husband of a dear friend of both of ours.
You're talking about Candy's husband. Yeah.
And all I can tell you is there are things that are very important, and there are things to have principles about. And yes, the principle, actually, Chris Matthews was sitting behind me at this funeral and was called out. Actually, on the sexism that occurred in this campaign. There was sexism in this campaign.
Oh, absolutely.
And
I have pointed it out on this program many times.
Right. But let's get people to think about what is at stake here. And that's what's important. And it takes someone,
Susie, we just have a couple seconds. Okay. We just had Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz on, and she was going on about how the people of Florida feel disenfranchised because only half of their vote counts, although the Democratic Party wants all of their money. I was expecting words of healing. How long is this going to go on?
I think that's very unfortunate from the Congresswoman, because I think what the committee did on Saturday was a reasonable response to an unfortunate situation. And I think that they did what they showed is that how people voted did count.
Yeah, I agree. Susie, we've got to wrap it up there. Susie Turnbull with the Democratic Party, number two person in the Democratic Party. Susie, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great talking with you. Tom Hartman here. I'm live in New York City all this week. We'll be back broadcasting from the headquarters of Air America. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com. This is the Tom Hartman Program.